Hello and welcome to Measurement Matters, the podcast that provides free tips and tricks on measuring the difference your activities have on people and the planet. My name is Matt Bevan and I'm your host. Joining me on this episode will be Dr. Rebecca Grace, who is a director at the Centre for Transforming Early Education and Child Health, known as TEACH, at Western Sydney University. If you haven't come across Rebecca, she is fantastic, and her passion is supporting children, particularly those that experience adversity. What I really appreciate about Rebecca is she is all about impact and using evidence-based approaches to change what we do day to day, which is super refreshing. In addition to talking about the benefits and challenges of measuring outcomes for children, and including their voice in that, we also talk about the need to focus on children's positive experiences and how the latest research in this area is challenging us to change our approaches and adapt the tools we use to track and measure progress. So without further ado, let's get started and see what we can learn and share together today. Rebecca, welcome.
Hi, Matt. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining me today. Look, Rebecca, before we go into a lot of discussion, I really quite like starting off when I talk about measurement, just around a definition of terms. So what is outcomes measurement or impact measurement mean to you?
So what it means to me is understanding the purpose of whatever the initiative or intervention or program or practice, you know, whatever is being delivered. It's about understanding the purpose of what's being delivered and seeking to understand whether what we think is being changing as a result of that program is in fact changing. It's about looking at effectiveness of our strategies. It's about looking to make improvements and to understand the impact that we're having on the lives of people. It's systemic, it's formal, but it's always about clarity and understanding the purpose of what we're doing and whether we're achieving what we actually have set out to achieve. That's what outcomes measurement is all about for me, really, and sitting at the heart of it is that notion of purpose and clarity around purpose. So that's what outcome measurement means to me. Are we changing what we think we're changing? Are we having the impact we think we're having? Are our programs effective in the way that we think they're effective? It's that sort of checking back and checking in on those kinds of issues.
Yeah, I love that. That's a beautiful description. And how did you decide this was something that you wanted to get involved in?
Look, you know, most little girls don't sit and dream about, you know, measuring outcomes or you know, impact frameworks. You know, so my desire was to be a psychologist and to be a child psychologist. And as I was studying, I certainly imagined myself in my future professional life, you know, being somebody working very directly with children and young people in a role as a psychologist. But I had some just fantastic early experiences as a student around research, and I was employed as a research assistant on a project. And, I took that job because, like most students, I was looking for a job, you know, not because I felt, you know, compelled or drawn to research in particular. I thought it was really interesting and I needed to earn some money while I was studying. But it was really life-changing to be employed in a research assistant role. And that project, that particular project, was all about the service and support needs of children who have disabilities and their families. So I got involved with research. It was a research project that was funded by DOCS back then, but, you know, Department of Communities and Justice. And I watched this sort of dance or this play between the researchers and the policymakers and the practitioners, and started to feel, you know, such a strong commitment and sense of the role that research has to play in good practice and in good policy, and the importance of the relationship and of working really closely together to be able to achieve good things and to support families. So research for me started to move out of the realm of an interesting intellectual exercise and moved into the realm of being critical to good practice and good policy. And so that I started to see that I could make a difference in lots of different ways in the world. You know, I was certainly somebody who was motivating by wanting to contribute positively and to make a difference. I have always had a very sort of very strong commitment to social justice, and so I wanted to be part of positive change in the world. And I started to see that that could happen in lots of different forms. So it certainly can happen in face-to-face work and in practice, but it also needs to happen at the level of policy. And the role of evidence and research was vital to those processes. And I think that shift in my mind really stimulated my interest in research and in the measurement of outcomes and the relationship between research and practice and policy. And so I just started down a path that I, you know, have found really rewarding and I hope ultimately, you know, makes a contribution. But I certainly see the importance of that relationship. So I don't subscribe to a model of researchers sitting in an ivory tower. Mm. I see research, or at least the research that I do, as absolutely critical to informing good policy, good practice, and bringing about positive change within society. So that was my introduction and my beginning of a research career, really.
That's wonderful. And what I particularly like about what you're saying is you're sort of redefining research in a way. You talk about it very much around, you know, moving the dial, action-oriented. You know, it's not just about writing reports or researching things to intellectually decide what's right or wrong or how, you know, it's you passionately want to create change.
Yeah.
And you see the opportunity for well done research or outcomes measurement, you know, in terms of understanding and then actually shifting the dial. And I think that's you know, that's a wonderful thing. It's a bit more rare than I think we'd like it to be. So you know, that's why I particularly appreciate this discussion.
It's an interesting space. Oh, sorry, Matt.
No, go.
Oh, yeah. It's an interesting space to sit in as a researcher, just because the whole academy or the university structure is really set up to support a different kind of research, which is much more, you know, about the pursuit of knowledge for knowledge's sake. And, you know, and there's great value in that work. I mean, that sort of work needs to be happening as well. But, yes, certainly for me, I am only interested in research as it is applied and as it is meaningful in practice and policy context. And I think there's a growing swell of researchers who have the same commitment and who are wanting to work in the same ways. I think, you know, research is changing in that way. And I do think, you know, I'm certainly not unique or alone. You know, in Australia, I can think of many other researchers who are also committed to this way of working.
And are you able just to sort of briefly talk to what you're most passionate about at the moment and what you're working on?
Yeah. Look, you know, like most people, our passions, you know, shift and what, although always underlying anything that makes me passionate is ensuring that we support children well, particularly children who experience adversity or marginalisation. So that is sort of my baseline passion that never goes away and that motivates most of what I do. But something that I've been thinking about a lot lately, so and that's really shaping and absorbing my energies and the way that I do research, is around an approach called the HOPE approach. So HOPE is an acronym that stands for Healthy Outcomes from Positive Experiences. So what this is about, let me see if I can sort of capture this whole approach in a fairly succinct way. But what it's about is pushing back a little bit against an exclusive focus on risk mitigation. So I'll try to, it's hard to capture a theory in a few words, but I'll do the best that I can. You know, so much of our funding and policy and practice and intervention strategies are about addressing adversity, about identifying risk and directly addressing that risk. And there's virtue in that. We of course want risk to be minimized for children. We of course want children who experience adversity. We of course are seeking to counteract that. But this HOPE approach argues that an important and a potent part of addressing adversity is ensuring that there are positive experiences in the life of a child. So it's arguing that we should invest equally in, you know, in risk mitigation and understanding risk, but also invest equally in actively facilitating and promoting positive experiences in the lives of children and young people. It sounds so obvious, and yet it isn't the way that our system works. We still employ very much an ambulance at the bottom of the cliff, type approach, where, you know, unfortunate things happen, and then we invest all of our money and all of our energy in trying to mitigate that or trying to help a child to heal from whatever sort of, terrible things have happened in their lives. And we don't spend enough time investing and thinking about what makes for a positive life. So there's been quite a bit of research that's done. We all know the research that sits around ACEs or adverse childhood experiences. So we all know that when children have adverse experiences in their lives, that this leads to lifelong outcomes in terms of poorer health, you know, less likely to be employed full time, housing stability, relationship stability. So we're all very clear in terms of that pathway, that adversity in the life of a child leads to, poor outcomes. But there's a growing body of research that shows that positive experiences in the life of a child can counteract adversity and support positive outcomes. And so, like, to give a sort of trite example, I suppose, just to make the point, you know, if we have a child that we know is struggling in terms of their own self-concept or self-esteem, we can put lots of programs in place. We can send them every Wednesday afternoon to a self-esteem course, and we can directly respond to the adversity or to the problem. And what we can do is understand the strengths of that child and look to proactively facilitate those. So maybe better than going to a self-esteem program on Wednesday afternoons might actually be to join the local swimming squad and to develop skills and to actively invest in positive experiences for that child. And there's more and more research showing that that kind of proactive investment in positive things is potent as a healing mechanism and potentially counteracts the impact of adversity. So if we sort of move it to a system level, you know, we know that if we take children in out of home care system, for example, you know, there's very clear research that indicates that when children are placed in the out of home care system, this does not necessarily lead to positive lifelong outcomes. There's an abundance of research that demonstrates that children who have engaged with the out of home care system often go on to have poor outcomes throughout their life. And that's a system that's entirely obsessed by risk mitigation, entirely obsessed by safety, trumping every other aspect. And I don't want to be misunderstood, and I don't want anybody to think for one moment that I don't think that risk mitigation and safety is vitally important. But what we know is that this current approach that's completely obsessed or focused on that approach doesn't necessarily lead to positive outcomes. So it's time to try something new. And what if within the out-of-home system we gave equal investment in time to safety and risk mitigation as we gave to identifying and proactively investing and promoting positive experiences in the lives of those children and young people? Would we see, you know, different outcomes? So that's something that interests me tremendously at the moment. I want to measure and understand positive aspects in a child's life as much as I want to measure and understand, you know, risk and adversity. And at the moment, yeah, so many outcomes frameworks are very dominated by seeking to understand risk and adversity. And so that's where we invest all of our money instead of understanding what's positive and proactively investing in that. I think it's also because, what I hear when I talk about this approach to policymakers and practitioners, the sort of feedback I get is we're completely flat out dealing with the crises. You know, we don't have any way to find resource or time to invest in those positive things. We're just trying to, deal with the disasters that are happening. But if you look at the science and you understand that investment in positive experiences is counteracting the adversity, it is healing, it is potent as a mechanism towards positive outcomes, then it's not just about a lovely add-in to deal with after a crisis. It's about a way of addressing crisis as well. You know, it's part of that response. So I don't know if I've captured that, but it's certainly something that I'm really interested in the moment, and that's shaping my research and the questions that I ask and how we ask them, and also my thinking about how we embed support and services for children and young people.
I think that's great. Look, it's really good. And we can talk a little bit about how this, about the measurement piece. But I think that idea that, if we want healthy, resilient adults, and we look at the evidence of what actually supports people, focusing on the absence of trauma is not enough. And it's not an either or thing. I think, about and, the importance, and we can see the power of positive experiences in shifting the dial and actually supporting people even when trauma is present. So there are great examples thriving adults who have gone through trauma, but the positive experience and the lens has helped shape them, shape that experience.
That's right.
So that feels, that feels like it is super, super important.
Yeah, I mean, it makes a lot of sense, really. It doesn't feel like it's revolutionary as an idea in and of itself.
No.
But where it's potentially revolutionary is in looking at how we structure and think about our policies and practices, because, as much as people can feel that it's fairly instinctive, we still have a system that's largely dominated by, risk mitigation and a focus on addressing adversity.
So in terms of the actual, because I'm just thinking in terms of sort of social services and how we support people in the child protection space, this is going to be challenging. I mean, this is going to be, and I don't think the shift is going to happen overnight, but what you're talking about is how we slowly start introducing this different focus. And it almost feels like we're going to have to create time where people can actually have these conversations around positive experiences.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking from the measurement point of view, what that looks like for a child, or are there any going on? And then actually how we shift the dial in terms of if there aren't any, how we create that time. And we actually have that focus on doing something so that we can see those positive experiences happening.
Yeah.
Is that what you're talking about here?
Yes, Matt. And I think you're right that, yes, you're right. No change happens quickly. So a shift takes a long time. But I do think the starting point is actually around measurement. I mean, we have endless sort of ACEs screening tools and screening tools focused on identifying adversity. I do think that one of the really important starting points is to simply measure. Let's start to measure and to identify what's positive. I think that's a really good starting point. I think your podcast is called Measurement Matters.
Well, I was gonna put a plug. I mean, measurement does matter. What we measure, what gets measured gets managed. And quite often, I think, we know about this, but if we have visibility for the children, we're supporting around, this idea that, no, I don't have any positive experiences in my life, so that we can actually sort of see that to act on it. And if we've got those metrics there, that builds up that narrative of what that looks like.
And I'd probably be so bold as to say that there wouldn't be many children who didn't have any positive experiences in their lives. I think that, sometimes it's about the lens that we apply, which sort of links to one of my other areas of passion, which is around hearing children's own perspectives and subjective experience. Sometimes we can sit back as professionals and think there is absolutely nothing in this child's life that's positive. All of these sort of terrible things are happening in all of these different spaces. But is that the perspective of the child? How would they identify what's positive? Maybe positive for them just exists in the form of a teacher that's kind to them. So there is a starting point, right? Because so within the hope approach, it talks about four building blocks of hope. So it talks about four areas in which it's important for children to have positive experiences. And the first one is about relationships. Now, in an ideal world, those positive relationships are with their primary carers. But for some children, there are positive relationships or relationships they establish in other places. So how do we facilitate and build those relationships? You know, one of the other building blocks is about safe and stable home environments. So how do we think about home environments? You know, perhaps there's lots that's disastrous, but perhaps the child enjoys their home and where they live. You know, a third is around participation and citizenship. So that's about being provided with opportunities to be involved in decision making and to express your views. And the fourth is around opportunities for social and emotional growth. So that's about play and, you know, opportunities to grow and to interact socially. So I would find it very surprising to find a child who couldn't identify some positive areas in their lives as a starting point, as a place to grow and to add fuel to that fire and seek to sort of build and encourage in those spaces.
So we've got these four pillars which are important to that positive experience and how we create healthy outcomes. I think the other thing you're talking to here, which is what I love about your work, is just stressing the importance of the child's voice.
Yeah.
And I think we should sort of just pause on that. Traditionally, that we haven't necessarily included children's voices in outcomes measurement. And I'm just wondering, what are the reasons for that? Why haven't we done that?
Well, there has been, because I think that we have such a tradition of seeing children their value exists insofar as they are becoming adults. So we see children, there's an expression that's used in the research literature, we see children often as human becomings. So not human beings yet, but little people who are growing into adults. And when you're an adult, that's when you actually matter and you're really important, right? But so what we need to do is we need to educate them really well, and we need to put all these sort of experiences into them because we're growing them into human beings. But that view of childhood has really evolved over time. And we've started to understand childhood as not just, you know, a preparation for adulthood phase of life, but a phase of life in and of itself that has value in and of itself. And of course, the people who understand childhood right now are those who are children right now. I mean, even those of us who have been children previously, which I think might be all of us, we can sort of retrospectively look at and reflect and think about our own childhood through our adult eyes, you know, but the context, the political context, the social context, all the context, all that sits around childhood changes over time. So I can certainly reflect, and that may be useful on some level, but the people who understand childhood right now are children, those with lived experience of being a child right now. And I think, you know, as that sort of shift has happened and we value childhood in and of itself, you know, that's where there's been this shift in research and in thinking that values subjective voice and values childhood, the lived experience of childhood. And that's reflected in a number of different spaces. So, you know, we know the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, for example, that was released in 1989, Article 12 of that convention specifically says that children have a right to be able to have their views taken into account, to express their views on issues that impact them and that are important to them, and that those views should be given due weight, you know, and considered and taken seriously. So it's actually now a right for a child to be able to express their views and engage around issues that are important to them if they want to engage, if they have a view to share. But also, I guess a third layer is that what we know about child well-being is that well-being is about how you feel inside yourself. So if we know, and we do know, because there's a great big body of research around this as well, we know that well-being in childhood is critical to adult and ongoing outcomes. You know, well-being is not what adults tell you that it should be. It isn't that you can say, right, child, you know, I've provided you with a good education and a safe home, so you should therefore feel happy, feel confident inside yourself and go on and do well in life. Well-being is about a child perceiving that they're safe, a child perceiving that they're loved, a child feeling that they have opportunities to learn and grow. Well-being is very much a subjective experience and so critical to outcomes. So it matters a lot to understand how children perceive their own well-being and to respond to that. I just had a recent conversation with my brother, actually, and my niece who was sitting at the table. And I said to her, how are you going? I know, how's school? And she said, I'm really struggling and I'm having some problems with some of my friends. And my brother, because he's a loving and caring father, said, oh, no, you're all right. Of course, you're fine. You're doing just fine. And those friends, oh, girls can be silly. You know, you're doing just fine. And he was telling her, you're fine, you're fine. While she's telling me, I'm not. I'm struggling with these different things. And I think we can do that as adults. We want children to be fine. We can do everything to support that. But ultimately what really matters is about how they're feeling within themselves and how they perceive, you know, their own well-being and what's happening in their life. And we need to be responsive to that.
I think that's a wonderful example, you know, and it sort of talks to that who should know and that idea that, you know, we're adults and, well, the child doesn't understand. They don't have this experience. They're not able to look through it in these different ways. They can't reflect, you know, they don't know what good or bad looks like. And all these things we use to justify why we don't want to have that conversation or truly really listen to what's being said. And this is a common challenge, I think, a lot of the time when we ask, we're trying to get people's voice around, you know, how we step into their shoes. We've got to overcome all that and say, well, actually, I'm not the expert. And whatever comes out, I've got to sort of engage in that process of letting you voice your truth and then see what comes out of that. And when you do it well, you always get surprised. It's not necessarily a simple or linear process and, you know, it doesn't necessarily fit with our frame of the world, but, you know, the importance of actually doing that.
I think one of the challenges in this space is that, you know, it doesn't mean that, so there are many stakeholders in any sort of decision that's made, and the mistake that's made and why there's sometimes some criticism around this approach is because people will say, well, we can't let children make all of the decisions. Of course we can't let children make all of the decisions. It's about all stakeholder voices in this space. So, for example, I did some research some years ago now talking to little children about preschool, and there were quite a few children who didn't want to go, who didn't want to go to preschool at all. But the argument then is, well, they don't want to go, so their voice should be privileged above all others. It's true that those children didn't understand the economic imperative in their family for both parents to work. You know, they didn't necessarily understand that. They didn't understand all that sits around this kind of decision making. So it isn't that we, by hearing these voices, we privilege them above all others. It's about contributing these voices and taking them seriously and weighing them seriously amongst all of the issues and the voices of all of the stakeholders who are part of any kind of decision making. And I think that's really important to understand, because it's definitely a pushback in the child voice space, that kind of what would they know? And we can't change anything or make any decisions on the basis of what they think anyway. But I think we can if we take them seriously as stakeholders and we take their views seriously. I think that's actually a really important point that you make.
That's a great way. Yeah, I think you've sort of nailed that. And it's the importance of all the different sources that we use to make decisions. And that this isn't going to force us to make decisions which don't make sense. It's just another source of information, and it can tell us things. I mean, it could tell us, you know, a load of things. If you don't enjoy it, well, what does that mean for the service and how can we work on it?
Exactly.
Not necessarily. Exactly. We're not going to send you to school because you don't enjoy school, because we know that school can be very, very good for a number of reasons.
Yes.
But then we can work on improving that experience.
Exactly. And that is it. So that's about taking that view seriously. So allowing it to have weight and then taking it seriously that, you know, there are this percentage of children who don't enjoy this context. Unfortunately, it's not an option to not engage. So how do we build and support and think about this service context and you know, and how it happens for children? I think I really like your summary.
The other thing I suppose that comes through is another complication with children is, you know, how they make sense of things at a point in time. And yeah. I think with older children, you know, there's quite a large range when we talk about children. But as children get younger and we ask them how they're going, there's something that happens there, doesn't there? You know, in terms of the sort of the how they are able to make sense of their life over time. What does that look like?
Well, of course, I mean, you know, children go through various stages of cognitive development and their sort of experience or ability to think long term, to sort of put different factors together. You know, of course, that develops over time. And so I think it's just very important to be aware of that. I mean, I collect data with young children often and have done so in many projects and gathered lots of really lovely and interesting data. But of course, we see it within the context of that child's developmental stage. And we know that young children are better at being descriptive than reflective or conceptual. So can I give you an example of how we might do research with young children, for example? Is that all right?
That'd be great. Yeah, that'd be really okay. Good.
So I can think of a few different projects, but one that's come straight to mind is I had a PhD student who was working with families who were engaged in a very intensive parenting program. So this was a court-ordered parenting program. The parents had to attend this program because, you know, they were at risk of having their children removed. So it was quite at the pointy end in terms of parenting programs. And she wanted to look at and understand whether children perceived difference in their households over time as the result of their parent attending this program. So for the little children, the younger children, what we did is just focus on the daily routines. You know, what happens during the day? Who plays with you? Who do you spend time with? What do you do? And we just sort of gathered their descriptions over time of the day and what was important to them. And what we saw over time was a shift where as time went on, children spoke more and more about time with their parents and play with their parents and those sorts of things that weren't present in the early interviews. And so, you know, on that basis, we sort of looked at and hypothesized that, you know, children were experiencing stronger interaction and more playful interactions with their parents and such that they had previously. Now, of course, we have to be careful in analyzing this data because, you know, the really tricky thing about children is they age over the course of a longitudinal study, right? So their development and their ability to reflect and think about these things also shifts over, you know, over a period of time. We can't hold them stagnant and control, you know, for development. But certainly we were able to detect over a 12-month period subtle changes in their narratives around their experience of home life. Now, what we would never have asked those children is, can you think about the way that you're parented and do you think there's been a change in the way that you've parented or that you've been parented? Does mummy yell less now than she used to? You know, is there less smacking in your house? You know, we would never, ever ask those kinds of questions. Wouldn't ask them of any child, even an older child. But, you know, we would never ask those kinds of questions that require a lot of conceptual thinking, a lot of reflection, a lot of, you know, sort of weighing up. We wouldn't do that. Instead, what we talk about is, what time do you get up in the morning? What happens when you wake up? Do you help to make dinner at night? Like, we focus very much on concrete, questions that children find quite easy to respond to and to start in that way. So it's about the, you know, whatever tools we use or however we approach and talk to children has to fit with their developmental stage. And then we think about what we take from that and how we analyze and think about that information. But, you know, another example, sorry, am I talking too much? Do you want me to?
No, it's great. I mean, there's so much in this. I think when I bring it back to the principles of measurement,
right?
You know, everything you do in terms of, you know, the voice, but also how you have that conversation. You know, this idea, even when I think about technical terms like indicators, you know, you talk about them in a very natural way of how to have a conversation with someone or to ask questions that give you back useful information that tell you something. Yeah. You know, so they're not developed in a sort of a box by clever people. They're developed, you're talking about developing things in you know, in partnership with children and in a way that really work for them, but then also gathering data which you can then act on.
Exactly.
And you can do stuff with. I mean, this is essentially it's almost a masterclass into how to do outcomes measurement.
Yeah.
And we often don't do that. You know, in reality, we have a lot of tools out there that are developed by people who think they know better and know how to, you know, these are the things I need to find out. So I'm going to ask the child whether there's less smacking at home, because
yes,
that's the number I need to then do this. But, you know, they haven't kind of worked through what that means and how that will go.
Oh, exactly. And I think that is such an important contemporary issue. More and more out there are off-the-shelf outcomes frameworks. So here's an outcomes framework for this. Here's an outcomes framework for that. There's some value in that. I mean, at least it's a starting point, and I think that's helpful on some levels. But it's so important that we take a very nuanced look at outcomes frameworks, because ultimately, or what they are, what any program or group or organization needs to think about is, what is our purpose? What do we think we are changing? And how can we look at whether or not we're changing that? That's all that outcomes frameworks are. And so it's so important that the outcomes that you choose are nuanced or are aligned with your mission and what you're seeking to achieve. So if, for example, you're running a program that is about, I'm trying to think of an example, but, okay, if you measure the wrong outcomes, you run a very serious risk of not being able to demonstrate change. If you're measuring the wrong things, you may measure your outcomes diligently and not be able to demonstrate change. And then what it looks like you have is an ineffective program, where what it could be is that you haven't plugged into and measured what your program changes.
Yeah.
So that's why the off-the-shelf models are difficult, because they're sort of general. They identify various outcomes that seem very, you know, sort of generic. But if they're not aligned with what your program is seeking to change, you run a very serious risk. In fact, you're better not to measure your outcomes than to measure the wrong outcomes.
And I think also when we think about this change in paradigm that we're trying to create, so we're going from a, you know, view of a system where we're trying to, you know, avoid negative experiences and really look at that sort of that system, to actually where we actually need to shift the paradigm now and talk to and measure and build evidence around positive experiences in the change. We can't use the old tools because they weren't developed taking that paradigm shift into account. So.
Right.
You know, I think, and this is one of the reasons I really enjoy, you know, being able to work with you on this, is how we actually build this, you know, what we're trying to create is a different focus.
Right.
How we actually build that into our measurement tools, because that hasn't been, I mean, it hasn't been done before. So this is new and groundbreaking work.
Yeah.
And I particularly like that idea that the measurement can actually shift the dial a little bit on how we actually support and change practice.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, and that's definitely where I think the starting point is in that work, in thinking about how and what we measure.
It's great. So, I mean, we could talk about this. We could talk about this all day, Rebecca. In terms of if people are listening to this and they're really sort of liking what you're talking about and want to find out more, how do they do that?
Oh, well, look, probably a good starting point is to just go to the website for the research centre that I lead. So I didn't really introduce myself, but I'm the director of a research centre at Western Sydney University, which is called TEACH, with two E's in it. So it's an acronym, but it's T-E-E-A-C-H. So it stands for Transforming Early Education and Child Health. So it's all about this transformative way of doing research. So if you go to westernsydney.edu/teach, T-E-E-A-C-H, you'll be able to see the work that we're doing. But, you know, I think there's great value in connecting with a researcher around this space, you know, whether it's me or whether there are other researchers in this space as well. And I think, you know, the importance is around finding a researcher that is applied, that will spend the time to think with you and understand the programs that you're delivering and what your key purpose is, and will engage with you around a nuanced approach to looking at outcomes. You know, I think that's really important.
And apologies, I usually give you an opportunity to introduce yourself at the beginning, but I will put a brief intro with introducing people so they know who you are before we talk. The other thing I'd really like to do, Rebecca, is just around, you know, this, whether there's a word of encouragement for people. I mean, there's a lot of people that listen to this and they're probably thinking, well, absolutely, that kind of, you know, that rings true, but I'm really struggling to get people to think about this in our organization. Like, I struggle with the idea of the child voice and how we can experiment with this. Do you have sort of words of encouragement for those people? Like, what should they do to get started on this journey?
Look, what I don't want to do is be guilty of self-promotion. I mean, you know, obviously the work that we do, and we have a training program around child voice and how to engage with children and young people in service and practice context. I don't want to be guilty of just using this podcast as an opportunity for self-promotion. I think that my advice is around being brave. So having a go, you know, being brave and taking some first steps around including just asking children how they feel or what's important to them, just very general and broad feelings. I mean,
I love that. I think the idea of being brave and just getting stuck in and seeing what you find, because this is so complicated, sometimes you just have to give it a go and see how you go and potentially refine that over time.
Absolutely. But if you are going to be brave, you must be prepared to listen. So there is no value in a tokenistic approach. In fact, it does harm. If it's a tokenistic approach where you start to, you know, say, okay, we're going to ask for children's opinion on this. If there is not a seriousness and a commitment to taking some kind of course of action around what's said, that doesn't mean, as I said earlier, adopting whatever the children are saying as the new position for the whole service organisation, but it does mean taking it seriously, and it does mean allowing it to weigh in, and it does mean respecting that children and young people have shared something with you, and so feeding back to them what you've done with the information that they've provided. So if you're going to be brave and step into this space, you need to be serious about being interested in listening and not being like my brother, who is like, oh, you're fine. Oh, she's a drama queen. Oh, you know, oh, that person's just having a bad day. If you're going to ask, you actually have to take seriously the listening. So that would be a starting point. In terms of embedding outcomes frameworks, I mean, it's really great if you can connect with researchers, because obviously we do this all the time. And so, you know, it's nice to have that experience, but sometimes organizations don't have the money or resources or can't find a researcher that they connect with or whatever. So in that space, I think it's about being brave again, about doing some real thinking about what you think you're changing, like actually trying to nail down and think about the difference that we're having, not broad, like, oh, we're helping families, or, you know, to move and beyond that sort of very vague level, to think about what do we think we're actually changing or influencing here? And have we got a way of looking at whether we are having that influence or not? Have we got a way of looking at that? And are we brave enough to change our practice if it doesn't look like we're having the impact we think we're having? And I think that's a huge question and a really important challenge within the sector, because we can become very committed to particular programs that we deliver. Sometimes there's almost a bit of a religious fervor that sits around a particular program. You know, people are converted to you know, Triple P or whatever, or not, I don't mean to just single them out, like converted to whichever kind of approach is being delivered. I think there's a real courage in saying our commitment is not to the program. Our commitment is to the families and to the children that we work with. So can we step outside a little bit and look at what we're delivering? And can we look at whether that's sort of creating the impact that we hope it's having? And if it's not, can we rethink the way that we deliver services or the approach that we're utilising? And I think there's actually a lot of bravery in both of those things.
That's wonderful. I think that's a really good call to action. And as you say, bravery, that is a really good reminder for people. Being brave and being open to changing the way we look at things, shifting our perspective, all of those things. I think that's wonderful. But Rebecca, we could talk about this all day. And I think I'd really like to check in again and have another conversation in time. For the purposes of today, though, I think we might end there. And I'll just say thank you so much for spending time and sharing your views and opinions with the listeners.
Thank you, Matt, and thank you so much for giving me a platform to talk about something I feel really passionately about for a little while. It's lovely to be able to do that.
It is awesome, the work you're doing. Really, really, really pleased we're connected.
Yeah, me too.
Thanks, Rebecca.
Bye-bye.
Well, how did that land for you? I think Rebecca has such a great way of explaining and bringing her work to life, so that we can all understand and make sense of some very clever and rigorous research. Whilst the work is super accessible, I feel we're not going to see change happen overnight. Introducing a paradigm shift to a system and developing new tools to help support that change will take time. However, with people like Rebecca supporting organisations, we'll get there. I highly recommend you connect with Rebecca, particularly if you're keen to include the voices of children in outcomes measurement, and are passionate about adding more of a focus on positive experiences in the lives of children you're supporting. As always, if you've got any feedback, then please get in touch. And if you want to speak on a future episode, then give me a call. For all of you out there having conversations about well-being and giving measurement a go, keep up the good work, because measurement matters.